From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the latest National Defense Authorization Act gave the U.S. military yet another financial boost with bipartisan support, there was little, if any, questioning over the spending of taxpayer funds on the Pentagon. Any discussion of human needs, like healthcare or education, elicits the question, how will we pay for it? When discussing the Pentagon's needs, there is no such concern. Having studied the U.S. military for decades, my guest today shares some of his reflections on this critical question. William Hartung is Director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy and a Senior Advisor to the Center's Security Assistance Monitor. He's the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. He writes regularly for Tom Dispatch. And his latest piece is called Lessons from Battling the Pentagon for Four Decades. Welcome to the program, William.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So I've had you on our show numerous times in the past, and you know, I can't remember a single time when we've talked about, oh, wow, look, the military is actually getting a small cut. It's almost always about the raises that the military gets. And you write about what you say is the stubborn persistence of the military-industrial state. So let's dig into some of your history covering the Pentagon and the work that you've done over the years. How long have you been doing this? Four decades? That's a long time. And in what capacity have you examined the U.S. military?
Well, it started when I was a student at Columbia in the late 70s, Columbia University. I was part of the anti-apartheid movement there, and I did a lot of research on violations of the arms embargo by Western military companies, both as part of my student activism and for a small independent magazine called Southern Africa. So that got me interested in arms corporations, and then I moved on to a job at a place called the Council on Economic Priorities in New York, which was researching kind of the social impact of corporate activity. So I wrote about the top contractors and arms sales policy and Reagan's Star Wars initiative and all about how it profited companies like Lockheed and others.
And so would it be fair to say that the United States military's persistent and, you know, generous raises of its budget are in part due to the money that private interests stand to make from this pouring of taxpayer funds into the military?
Yes, for sure. I think it's a combination of greed and ideology, but certainly the fact that, for example, the top five contractors, Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Raytheon, General Dynamics, Boeing, they split $100 billion a year out of the Pentagon budget, and contractors overall get almost half of it. So there's a lot of talk about, you know, you got to fund this because it's for the troops. It's as much or more so for Lockheed Martin than it is for the troops. And a lot of what they make is not necessary, like the new generation of nuclear weapons, which actually are making the world a much more dangerous place. And they spend money on campaign contributions. They spend tens of millions on lobbying. They deploy their factories in key congressional districts. So members are faced with being accused of voting against jobs in their district if they vote down, you know, something like the F-35 combat aircraft, for example. And there's the revolving door, you know, where people go back and forth from industry and government. They create this clique in favor of higher spending, including Trump's last three defense secretaries all have had industry ties. Either Mattis was on the board of General Dynamics, Patrick Shanahan was an executive for Boeing, and Mark Esper was top lobbyist for Raytheon. So it's probably more blatant under Trump, but it's been a consistent set of relationships going back, you know, before Eisenhower gave his military-industrial complex speech in 1961.
Right. People forget that we had a president who coined that phrase, the military-industrial complex. And if you listen to the speech in which he said that today, it sounds radical from a progressive perspective. So the general reaction or the general justification for a bloated military budget has been national security. Some might be more honest and say military dominance. But another reason that's often given is the creation of jobs locally, that funding the military creates jobs in certain states. How much of an issue is that? Is it worth pouring the taxpayer dollars into the military for the jobs that are supposedly created from fueling this military-industrial complex?
Well, University of Massachusetts economists have demonstrated that almost any other way of spending money creates more jobs than military spending. Green infrastructure would be about 1.5 times as many jobs per dollar spent. Education about twice as many. So there's other ways to create jobs. It's really about politics that the Congress and recent presidents have not been willing to invest in public needs, but are willing to throw hundreds of billions of dollars at the Pentagon. So the Pentagon has sort of used, along with the contractors, what I would call job blackmail. Hmm. They're saying basically you can have these jobs or you can have no jobs. So if you're working on a, ballistic missile submarine in Connecticut and your choice is to be a welder building submarines or to work as a greeter at the local casino for 1/3 the wages, it's a very difficult position to be in. So it's really about changing national priorities and then making sure that the skills that are now being, in my mind, significantly wasted on building weapons of war could be used to make sustainable infrastructure and other things that we need, especially as we're facing the prospect of a severe climate crisis.
And of course, the other reason why this repeated financial raise that the military gets is that it's been a largely bipartisan affair. Democrats and Republicans will go to the teeth battling on all sorts of issues. But when it comes to throwing money at the military, they're often united.
That's correct. Arms sales and military spending have too often been bipartisan objectives. And I think a lot of that is the arms lobby. Democrats don't want to vote against jobs in their state or districts. There's also the fear factor, both the fear that the public is subjected to about, demonizing potential enemies, but also the fear of members of losing jobs because they'll be seen as soft on defense, losing their office. So I think those things have conspired so that there's a few members who will speak out, like Representative Ro Khanna. Senator Elizabeth Warren has made cutting the Pentagon a specific plank of her campaign. Bernie Sanders has talked about it. But when you get into the nitty-gritty of passing legislation, very hard to get Congress to actually reduce the Pentagon because there's pork barrel politics, there's various other factors at play that make it extremely difficult, as we saw in the recent National Defense Authorization Act, where they approved near record levels of spending.
Now, you point out in your article that you wrote on Tom Dispatch that one of the lessons you learned from taking on the Pentagon for 4 decades was that grassroots protest efforts do work. And you point out in particular one part of the campaign against nuclear weapons during the Reagan years. You called it the one anti-militarist surge that did make progress. Tell us that story and how it can be a model for combating this relentless drive to pour money into the Pentagon.
Well, when Ronald Reagan came into office, he was spouting rhetoric about the Soviet Union as an evil empire. He joked before his weekly radio address that the bombing would start in 5 minutes. He launched a major nuclear weapons buildup across the board, including short-range nuclear missiles in Europe, which would put a hair trigger on a potential nuclear war. So between the European nuclear disarmament movement and then the nuclear freeze movement here in the United States, basically a grassroots effort was built up over a fairly short time of a few years. And it was everything from, trying to pass a sense of Congress against building new nuclear weapons to referenda in states and cities around the country. And it was quite effective. In fact, Francis Fitzgerald, who wrote a book called Way Out There in the Blue, which was mostly about the Star Wars program, talked about how Reagan's advisors were getting nervous because the peace movement was growing beyond the usual suspects to the mainline churches, to people that could hurt them politically at the polls. So he didn't pass the freeze per se, but he did negotiate an end to that notion of putting these short-range missiles in Europe. He negotiated what led to the first actual reductions of nuclear weapons in the nuclear age. And he also spoke about how you could never win a nuclear war. He moderated his rhetoric about the Soviet Union. Of course, part of that was the work of Mikhail Gorbachev and the initiatives that he took. But the fact that Reagan, you know, took up some of that was definitely an achievement of the anti-nuclear movement.
And the today, the situation today, I'm wondering how you can apply that to that story from during the Reagan years to the Trump years. Obviously, Trump is not Reagan, but he is from the conservative party. And Democrats are battling him politically on other fronts. It was so interesting that they signed on to the NDAA at the same time that they're impeaching him, just as an aside. As if to show that it's nothing personal, that they're on the same page with him when it comes to U.S. military funding, but they just didn't like what he did on the Ukraine scandal. But I'm wondering if it would be just as effective today to take on the Pentagon funding, or are there new conditions that we need to account for? On the, we do have some allies in Congress, as you pointed out, to Ro Khanna.
Yes, well, I think there's a new surge of activism on this issue, which I find very hopeful. There's an organization called Beyond the Bomb, which is working in universities and localities around the country to build a movement that says the president should never be allowed to engage in a nuclear first strike. There's a group called People Over Pentagon, about 20 organizations, not just traditional peace groups, but immigrant rights groups and environmental groups and others. That are pushing the presidential candidates to call for substantial reductions in Pentagon spending, which has worked to a significant degree among the progressive side of the ledger. And then the Poor People's Campaign has published a moral budget, which would virtually cut the Pentagon budget in half to fund domestic programs. And that was done in partly through work with Institute for Policy Studies. So there's more new initiatives about doing something about this. And I think they're driven in part because the public is tired of war. Even some of the Trump supporters are acknowledging that Afghanistan and Iraq have largely been disastrous. They haven't made the United States or anybody else any safer. That's why Trump gives lip service to those ideas himself, although he is not likely to implement that rhetoric. He knows that it plays well with his base. And then there's immense needs, the Green New Deal, Medicare for all the kinds of things we'll have to do to deal with the climate crisis. Just don't make it acceptable that we're spending, $750 billion a year on the Pentagon. And if you count other national security related items, it pushes it well over $1 trillion. So I think there's a lot of forces at play that could make a difference now, and people are getting active. There's some efforts to make greater links between pushing for Pentagon reductions and all the other emerging movements in the country. So, I was kind of embarrassed to acknowledge in the piece that I've worked on this for four decades because I didn't want to seem like, just like the old guy, reminiscing about the old days kind of thing. Well, back in my day, but anyway, it's still my day, thankfully. And, I think there is an important upsurge of activism that I think can make a difference on this issue, but it's never certain, as it is with any of the things we undertake. And certainly we have well-funded well-honed lobbying machine that we're up against. But I do believe that things can change on this front, and we need to push for change.
Just as the NDAA was being signed, or before that, we had the revelations from the Washington Post, the Afghanistan papers, showing how officials had lied about the success of that war, which is the longest official war in U.S. history. And we've spent over $1 trillion on that war, and we'll continue to spend on taking care of the troops that have served there. And I think that juxtaposition of the human needs versus the military's budget is such a critical one. As you mentioned, with the Green New Deal and also the Poor People's Campaign linking those issues, healthcare has emerged time and again as a critically important issue for voters when it comes to election years and polling. And yet the two parties continue to throw money together at the military. Now, what about this idea that you also point out in your article that the U.S. essentially needs bogeymen in order to convince the public that we have to keep pouring money into the military? Are today's bogeymen Russia and China and to a smaller extent North Korea? You know, the Taliban is essentially someone that we're coming to the peace table with. Iraq is sort of out of the picture, even though the violence there continues thanks to our war. But the effective demonizing figures are those countries like China and Russia, Iran?
Yes. You know, I think it's misplaced, this kind of whipping up of fear over these countries. There's certainly issues to be addressed. But with Iran, for example, had Trump not abandoned the Iran nuclear deal, that could have been the foundation for kind of a detente between the U.S. and Iran, and an ability to kind of, you know, also with the Gulf states and Iran, to kind of cool tensions at least while other issues were sorted out. And that opportunity was thrown away by Trump. Russia has a military budget about 1/10 of the United States. And to the extent that it interferes in Ukraine or backs Assad or does other things, tries to interfere in elections, none of that requires a bigger U.S. military to address. If anything, the biggest thing we could do to deal with Russian interference is a better educated public in the United States, get rid of voter suppression, take, you know, money out of politics. We want a genuine democracy. We've got a lot of things we could clean up in our own house that have very little to do with Russia. And of course, China is a growing power, and that has to be reckoned with. And I think the United States should do so by looking for areas of cooperation with China, particularly on things like climate change, and accepting that there's not a kind of a military thrust that's going to prevent China from becoming a more powerful state. And of course, China has its own issues. Its crackdowns on the Uyghurs, its treatment of labor, its internal environmental policies, even its big economic initiatives like the Belt and Road Initiative have drawn pushback because of the way they've been carried out in terms of environmental and economic sustainability. So China's not 10 feet tall. It's another global power that has to be dealt with, but it should be dealt with at least as much through looking for ideas of cooperation and how to prevent conflict, and not just spinning out these war scenarios that the Pentagon does, which if any of them were ever carried out, would be an unprecedented disaster in terms of the safety of the planet.
Right. We are preparing for, you know, just given the sheer amount of money that pours into purchasing military hardware, we're preparing for multiple world wars and planned nuclear holocaust that we hope will never happen, but we have the hardware to make it happen instead of a well-fed, healthy population that's well-paid. William, what about the ways in which the weapons lobby and the industry, the corporate industry that financially benefits from keeping the budget high, how have they changed their tactics, if at all, over the past, you know, few years? The campaign finance laws have changed over the years. We have Citizens United, the Citizens United decision allowing for dark money to be poured into elections. Trump promised to drain the swamp, but there are more lobbyists than ever. And there are former industry insiders in very high positions of power during his tenure, including all the way at the top. The Defense Department head at one time was someone who was an executive from a major corporation that makes money from the military. So how have military industrial complex lobbyists changed their tactics?
Well, I think a lot of them are consistent with what's happened over the years. Certainly this revolving door between industry and government has been longstanding. It's been, you know, for decades. I think one thing that happened in the 90s was the consolidation of the industry. So Lockheed and Martin Marietta merged, and Northrop and Grumman, and Boeing bought McDonnell Douglas. And you had this concentration of about five companies that get a vast bulk of the contracts. And they also have a bigger geographic reach, so they can influence members all over the country. I think they've also tried to, through funding think tanks, play a role in the shifting of the fear from terrorism to Russia and China. There was a National Defense Strategy Commission that was appointed by Congress that said the Pentagon wasn't spending enough, amazingly enough, and that had most of the representatives there had some sort of industry ties on boards of corporations or think tanks funded by the Pentagon and so forth. So I think in addition to traditional lobbying, they've tried to shape the debate. And my colleague Ben Freeman early next year will be putting out a report on industry funding of think tanks and how that sort of skews the Washington conversation.
Do you finally think, William, that there isn't enough attention being paid to the size of the U.S. military budget by young activists? Is this an arena of progressive work that could do with a little bit more PR, drawing greater attention to how much money flows into the military?
Yes. I mean, I think there is awareness. If you look at the Black Lives Matter platform, they're quite aware of the militarization of U.S. policy and the huge waste of resources going into the Pentagon. I think it's a question of finding a way to integrate it into the actions and programs. But of course, there are people who are quite progressive who have no idea that the Pentagon is such a huge, has such a huge purchase on our resources that we need for other things. So I think it's a combination of figuring out the best tactics and mix of tactics and a greater public education, because polls have shown that younger generations are more progressive in terms of anti-interventionism, questioning the Pentagon, even the notion that somehow the U.S. has to be this exceptional power that dominates the world militarily, economically, culturally, et cetera. So there's a lot of fertile ground, I think, for interchange between the traditional peace movement and the new emerging movements, which is where a lot of the the energy is at the moment.
Well, William, where can people find out more about the work you do? And also, can you recommend some websites where that, where the statistics, those numbers, the reports that we need to show how bloated the military budget is, any websites you can recommend?
Sure. Well, my, organization, Center for International Policy, is at internationalpolicy.org. So all my reports are there. I write regularly for Tom Dispatch. And also, surprisingly, I've got a little column at Forbes where they, for the moment at least, let me trash the military-industrial complex full-time or whenever I am so inclined. And then places like the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies does very detailed trade-off information on Pentagon spending versus domestic investments. And you can organize it by state, by locality, the national picture. So that's a hugely important and valuable tool. And then there's organizations like the Friends Committee on National Legislation and Women Without War that give a good guide for progressives to when there's actually votes in the Congress that can make a difference and how they might weigh in. So those are a few of the cases. I would also say the Project on Government Oversight, which did a big report on this revolving door phenomenon, which has been very helpful to our work, just exposing the workings of the weapons lobby.
Well, William, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll also post a link directly to your article that we've been discussing in Tom Dispatch. Really appreciate your work.
Yes, thanks for having me.
My guest has been William Hartung, Director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy, also Senior Advisor to the Center's Security Assistance Monitor. His books include Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. He writes regularly for Tom Dispatch, and we've been discussing his latest piece, Lessons from Battling the Pentagon for 4 Decades. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now Spotify.